Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Read with Michelle Martin on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
On Money FM 89.3, Singapore's most influential radio station, I'm Michelle Martin, and today we are reading The Rise of Techno-Socialism, How Inequality, AI, and Climate Will Usher in a New World. And we're speaking with co-authors Brett King and Dr. Richard Petty. It's a book that believes that even as forces of disruption challenge our most deeply held ideologies or models of politics, economics, and even our social constructs, that humanity will adapt in ways that, quote, we can't yet imagine. One possibility for the future is the emergence of a technologically driven collective social purpose. Systems of the world, the authors say, pitch us against each other for profit, tribe versus tribe, nation versus nation. But the authors say it's time for humanity to focus on competing for the future of humanity together. What could that look like? What could that entail? Welcome to Read. I'm Michelle Martin, and welcome authors of Techno-Socialism, Brett King and Dr. Richard Petty.
Thank you very much for having us on.
Great to speak with you. All right, here's a question. Dr. Petty, maybe you could kick us off. Meritocracy and competition underpin capitalism and democratic systems. What is techno-socialism? Is it a call to reform capitalism, and does it challenge the way democracies currently function?
It's a different view of a future economy. It's an economy in which technology enables scale of government and economy to work in a way that's optimal for the future of humanity. It's not setting aside all of the principles that have applied to date, but it is looking for a reformation of many of those principles in a way that's going to align with where the future's headed in terms of technology and the economy.
Brett, help us understand the elevator pitch for this book for our listeners.
Sure. Well, you know, we know that by 2050, there's going to be somewhere between 300 million and a billion eco-refugees. We know artificial intelligence could take up to 50% of the jobs that we have today, and that's just the start. And so these alone, present major challenges in terms of the way the economy needs to function and the way, you know, society's organizing principles need to work. But you throw in inequality and the gap between rich and poor, and it's becoming quite urgent because ultimately the current system is built, you know, from economically speaking, only to empower a very small percentage of the population. And we're not going to solve these problems unless we really work together. That's really the key.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, ultimately, does this book present a hopeful view for the future? Dr. Petty?
Yeah.
We think so. I mean, to your point of meritocracy and competition, mm-hmm. competition isn't going away. And we believe that AI will enable a new form, a new type of meritocracy that's probably an improvement on what we've experienced today.
All right. Let's start.
Yeah, the way we summarize it is, you know, the problem with this competition against each other, mm-hmm. that is largely inefficient, that humanity, historically speaking, is at its best when we work together. And so the focus is on capitalism that creates competition for humanity rather than against each other.
I want to focus on some of the greatest forces of disruption that this book has identified, and perhaps if we could whittle it to, sharpen it to forces of disruption that will matter to investors. Dr. Petty, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Well, there are the obvious ones, which is technology, and then the big question around globalization, particularly given the pandemic and how globalization is going to play out. The rise of Asia is a force which has been underestimated by many for the past 20 years. And I'm not just talking about China there, but ASEAN, of course, is a huge driving force. China is obviously a major player, and then India. So if you match up GDP with population, Asia and ASEAN, China and India in particular, are falling well behind in terms of population versus GDP. We think that gap's going to narrow and that they're going to become more prominent and more dominant in many ways economically into the future. So that's a major force shaping it. And you combine that with technology and the digital economy, and there's a period of change that's happened in the last 10 years that's unprecedented, but in the next 10 and 20 will be even more startling and remarkable.
We've been discussing a lot about the recent crackdown on technology companies in China, and how how is China placed, in your view, the US, when it comes to benefiting from some of the digital transformations that the book describes? Does China have a lead in the tech race still?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, China, from an infrastructure perspective, is treating artificial intelligence and these technologies, including solar for energy, as key infrastructure and elements that will enable it to compete in the 21st century. Their education approach is very different to the US. We've seen how difficult in the US has been just to get a $1 trillion infrastructure bill passed. China invests 8% of their GDP in infrastructure, including in the Belt and Road. You know, so China stands to be much better prepared for the type of jobs and the type of skills and the type of production that is needed in the 21st century. And that is one of those inflection points. We don't quite know how the US will respond to this when China surpasses the US as the world's number one economy. But, you know, that's a critical turning point, or inflection point, if you like, in human history coming up.
Dr. Petty, what do you read about China's crackdown on, you know, whether it's where the data is going to the CCP or to in the hands of technology companies in China, or cracking down on crypto mining in China? How do you see the crackdown and where that puts China versus the US in the tech race?
In terms of China, I think it aligns with their broader policies. If one reads the five-year plans that come out and looks at China's overall master plan, for want of a better term, it aligns closely with that. It's about economic stability and ensuring that no one's left behind, and that the economy moves in tandem and there's economic harmony, harmony above all else. And just because there have been some changes in the tech environment vis-a-vis the companies and the private interests there, doesn't mean that China itself is taking a low-value approach to tech. The tech is still there, the ideas are there, the creativity is there, the people are there. And whether it's in state hands or private hands, China has shown itself to be remarkably adept at changing and adapting to what's happening on the global stage. So in terms of technology, they're ahead in many ways. They have, and in others, they're catching up. So it's a mixed bag. But the, you know, what might have appeared in the media regarding technological shift and the balancing of ownership of technology, I think won't play into this so much. I mean, to take one example, the central bank digital currency. China has clear incentives and motivation to, now that it's launched the CBDC, to make that a winner and make that work. That plays into the digital economy in various ways, in various meaningful ways, and they're way ahead of many other economies in that regard. So it'll be transformational. What's happening now is transformational.
I wonder if your book talks about decentralization. And I mean, aren't CBDCs antithetical to this whole idea of cryptocurrencies, which sort of stand outside our established fiat currencies and transfers of monies? Does your book speak to decentralization?
Yeah, well, certainly there's an element of control that one gives up if one can no longer control the currency. But fiat money, the death bell is rattling. You know, we can hear that toll. But in fact, the bell probably rang some time ago. It's just that people haven't fully realised that yet. Not everyone's fully realised that. I think if you look at CBDCs in particular, China started embracing that 7-8 years ago, exploring it in a meaningful way. A couple of years after that, launched trials. A couple of years after that, so around 2018. And then has a system and an architecture that's ready to go and ready to roll out when they feel the time is right. And it's no surprise that there's been a regulatory tightening that's gone hand in hand with their ascension in terms of CBDC and the work they've been doing there. So, yes, from a regulatory standpoint, it does give greater control, and it is antithetical perhaps to what one might think of when traditionally one thinks about DeFi and cryptocurrencies. But in another sense, it's a way to view it as just another form. There's greater state control, but it's still a move towards the digital economy and a decentralization of financial interests.
Help our listeners understand what your book, The Rise of Technosocialism, says about the future of money. You say the death knell has already rung some time ago. What does your book say about the future of money, decentralized finance, and what it means for institutions like banks and states?
If we look at the evolution of money over the last centuries, you know, it's tended to be focused on trade and value exchange as sort of the core mechanisms. So, you know, cryptocurrencies and CBDCs are a natural evolution of money that's got to work in a digital economy. So the 21st century economies, you know, is it more real time. We have automated supply chains coming, you know, all of these elements that really change the nature of commerce. As e-commerce has already changed, as we've seen digitization, you know, increase during the pandemic. So that's one element is just, you know, the evolution of the internet and technology allowing instantaneous trade across the world requires fit for purpose type currency and money. But the other element really is, you know, sort of the core focus of the economy and how wealth is distributed. You know, we identify inequality as a core problem, but really the challenge is that economies will need to be, you know, to work better for their citizens in the first place. And so you know, today we look at GDP growth and, you know, unemployment figures, market surplus, trade surplus, as ways we think about the success of an economy. But if it can't cater for the needs, the basic needs of citizens, then our argument in techno-socialism is that it's not a functional economy. So you combine these two things and you're really looking at, you know, how are economies in the future going to value humans when high levels of automation sort of essentially take humans out of the labor force, but the economy still needs to provide for the basic needs of those citizens. If you're no longer judged as an individual by your economic output in the system, you know, what, you know, how is that going to be catered for? So we think that the nature of money, the nature of wealth, the, you know, the way we think about those measures is going to go through ultimately a philosophical change as a result both of artificial intelligence, the way we are tackling inequality, and of course the impact of climate change.
So if we look at that philosophical change to what money is, what it stands for, how it relates to the value that we bring to the production chain, what is your outlook for the US dollar?
We're not bullish on the US dollar in the book. You know, if you look at the Belt and Road Initiative alone, plus the advanced trials of CBDC in China, you know, we're going to see the first, you know, real in public use of the central bank digital currency during the Beijing Olympics. That's what we're hearing. If we see China double down on trade where their CBDC underpins trade on the Belt and Road, you know, that could definitely weaken the petrodollar in terms of its long-term potential. But the real issue in the US is the US economy, while it has a number of, you know, very highly performing tech companies, they're still very much looking in the rearview mirror when it comes to their core industries and their core skills. They're not teaching their kids at school the right sort of skills for the 21st century. So functionally, the US has a number of challenges moving forward.
All right.
Something else we note in the book, Michelle, is if you look at the two major crises of the last 15 years, if you take the GFC and then the coronavirus pandemic, the policy responses largely have been the same. It's been print money, deal with it through monetary policy and hope for the best, give subsidies and government handouts and again, hope for the best. But if you look at the toolkit and the mechanisms that have been used to try and get us through GFC and then get us through the pandemic, think back to the GFC, the printing of money and the toolkit that was used then, which is materially the same as the toolkit that's been using now, only tapered in, 2013, 2014, and then it was 5-6 years before the pandemic hit. So we didn't have a very long gap before the same toolkit was being used for a very different type of shock. And with the death of money, you can't keep printing money. You can't print 40% of US dollars in under 2 years and not expect inflation, particularly when real productivity isn't increasing in the way it should. So one can see a scenario in which AI leads to productivity improvements, but in an environment where there's inflation because the dollar is still being held onto and still being used as the global currency or the benchmark for global trade, in an environment where there's inflation that starts to spike and take hold and potentially stagflation as AI disrupts employment.
I was speaking with Mark Mobius recently. He's got a great book out, and he argues that technology and the way it's bringing prices down, the use of technology in production chains, for example, is going to lead not to inflation but deflation. And I wonder what your views are on what we can expect next year, perhaps, or in the years to come, given what we've seen monetary policy, try to cope with the pandemic.
A lot of it's going to depend in the short term on supply chain and logistics and the ability to catch up, speed up. I mean, take the book in point, one that we've just co-authored. One of the issues we confronted with the book is that just getting books on shelves was a major problem because of disruption to supply chain, and that's being felt by everybody through supply chain. So if you look at shipping costs and you look at wait times and lead times, they're very long and they're growing longer, and they haven't been managed as well as they could be, not because the willingness to manage wasn't there, but because of the pandemic itself and the restrictions around travel and transportation. So, look, deflation is possible. We're going to have to wait and see. In the short term, we're already seeing inflation. We're seeing headline inflation. Whether there's going to be wage inflation and asset price inflation remains to be seen, but we're already seeing that's systemic. But we're already seeing instances in many economies of spikes in wages. There was a story last week that I read in one country where the wages for dishwashers have almost tripled, and they're close to $100 an hour. From where they were pre-pandemic, and that's because nobody wants to wash dishes. They've been receiving money from the government as a handout. They're not prepared to go out and wash dishes. But if you don't have people doing that job, then you can't run a restaurant. So as this filters through and feeds through the economy, there are going to be real problems to deal with. The cost of production can come down, but the goods have to be able to get to market. Not everything is yet an intangible, although intangibles are going to become increasingly dominant in the future economy, as they have been for the last 20 years in the present economy.
Now, every time we do a show, inevitably we end up talking about the world of tokenization and property or NFTs. And I read in your book, you say the rapid rise of non-fungible tokens or NFTs are significant to the formation of the future economy. How so? How will NFTs be crucial to the future economy?
So one of the key issues here is we're trying to find a way to create, a digital record of physical assets and physical wealth that we have in the world as we shift to a largely digital economy. So patent, IP law, the way we think about contracts, all of that is going through a change based on these core technologies we talk about, like the blockchain, smart contracts, and so forth. I don't think NFTs are the ultimate solution or the end game of this, mm-hmm. but it is a way that we're trying to find experimentally how to carry over physical objects and physical assets into the digital economy of the 21st century. So you can see it as sort of the evolution of our economies, really.
We talk in the book a lot about the knowledge innovation creative economy, the KIC, and the NFTs apply to knowledge innovation and creativity in the way that Brett's described in relation to, say, patent law. But in terms of enabling creators of content to be paid for their work, and if NFTs are transformational.
If you try to mint an NFT, you realize you have to enter into the cryptocurrency universe. You need to pay an Ether a lot of the time if you want to mint an NFT. So you're seeing like this huge group of people needing to enter into the cryptocurrency universe if they want to be part of the NFT economy. So I want to just tail back a little bit. And we talked a little about the future of money, and we spoke about your outlook for the US dollar, but what do you see in terms of outlook for Bitcoin? Is Bitcoin going to crash under the weight of regulation?
Well, Bitcoin, has been underestimated at almost every turn globally. The total cryptocurrency market now exceeds $3 trillion. So by conventional terms, it's a runaway success. But as you pointed out, it's a decentralized solution in very centralized economies, trying to figure out how to the traditional finance industry and central banks have been seeking control over Bitcoin throughout that period, and we can see what instability that creates, such as when China banned mining. But on a longer term basis, we're 13 years into the Bitcoin journey. Mm. If someone could have stopped it, if that was the intent, then I think they would have. So I don't think that's highly likely that Bitcoin's going to fail one day and go to zero. Having said that, it's also not probably going to be the world's central reserve digital currency either, because the design elements of Bitcoin make it more like digital gold than it is a digital currency. But we see a lot of stable coins emerging right now that I think could be real competitors against central bank digital currencies because of the decentralized nature of those coins, perhaps the anonymity of the transaction networks, and also potentially the efficiency of those networks working outside of the need for wallets. Part of this parallels the growth of mobile wallets. In Singapore, I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of Alipay and Tencent WeChat Pay and the success those wallets have had. But mobile wallets, one of the great capabilities that we'll see over the next few years that really differentiate them from traditional bank accounts is that you'll have a lot more flexibility in the type of cryptocurrencies and other things you can attach intelligently to your mobile wallet for day-to-day transacting. So wallets could get to the stage where they're completely agnostic as to the underlying currency we use to purchase things. And at that point, really all bets are off in terms of, Bitcoin versus the US dollar as an example, because, your wallet could choose that. We talk about the potential for things like carbon coins and other, mission-based or passion-based cryptocurrencies as well, and with smart contracts and, AI, talking to each other in terms of commerce, the potential for more types of money or more types of cryptocurrencies emerging is very strong.
Brett was an early adopter. I came to it a bit later than Brett. I don't think Brett was the one, but Brett could have been the one that did the infamous or famous pizza trade for Bitcoin.
Expensive slice of pizza. How much did you pay for that, Brett? Yeah.
No, it wasn't. I'm pretty sure it wasn't Brett, but I remember speaking to Brett around the time about this. So my understanding of Bitcoin came a bit later. But look, the interesting thing to note about Bitcoin is that in terms of wealth accretion, it's arguably, Brett probably is, I haven't done the test, the fastest accretive asset class in terms of wealth ever, certainly in nominal terms. So we're talking $2 trillion plus on crypto generally in a pretty short space of time. And there's institutional backing and investment and increasingly more adoption by institutions and funds, as well as well-known individuals of the currency. But as countries ban it, Michelle, back to your point about countries perhaps banning Bitcoin and what's going to happen, we think, and we talk about in the book, the regulatory arbitrage that is already happening and is likely to happen, where some nations will ban and others will look at it as an opportunity to accept currency and transactions in crypto.
And then is it going to be the case of, with so many joiners, you don't want to be isolationist and left out of the system?
I think there's a bit of that, but it's also a bit of the fact that, what sort of investment do you want to attract into your market? What sort of production capabilities do you want to build? How are you going to remunerate people as you, move into a knowledge-based economy? All of those elements are part of the competitive landscape that we're going to see emerging.
All right. And before we let you go, because we're coming up against a heartbreak, the news coming our way in just a bit, the book talks about how inequality, climate and AI is going to usher in a new world. And that's interesting. How do you see AI impacting the way we work and the way we live?
Well, the biggest change is going to be the fact that, as we automate more and more of society, that we won't be working 9 to 5 to put food on the table like we do today, that we'll be able to pursue the type of work that really matters, that we're passionate about. And we do see something like a universal basic income or universal basic asset system coming into play. So the basic needs of the economy serve the citizens first and foremost before, corporations more broadly. So it is a sort of a philosophical change, but the role of work is definitely going to change over the next 30 years.
So is AI going to worsen inequality with the replacement of jobs?
That's why we wrote the book, because it has the potential to, if you look at today, the inequality in the United States, which is the worst inequality the U.S. has ever faced, part of that is that the largest companies in the U.S. today, which are all technology companies, employ far less people than the blue chip industrials of 30 years ago as an example. And so this is a structural change in the economy. Ironically, we're going to face both techno unemployment and labor shortages as AI comes into play because of sort of the mismatch of skills. But once we're through that process, we really need to find a way to, you know, value humans in the economy that isn't linked to how many hours they work on a factory floor, for example.
All right, I keep seeing
the disruption's happening, and the disruption's going to accelerate. It's a matter of ensuring there isn't a disconnect between the labor market and the economy as that happens.
Okay, final question. Which economies, in your view, could emerge winners or losers, given your view of the future that you map out in techno-socialism?
Rich and I are both a big fan of China. We see that its strategic importance as an economy is going to be critical. We think the Nordics will perform quite well in respect to sort of basic transition of the economy because of, their view of social needs and social causes. But beyond that, all bets are off to some extent. It really depends on energy transition and a number of other things.
The US certainly has the potential to do well. It's got the talent, it's got the IP, it's got the work ethic and the education system at large. But there are steps that need to be taken to ensure that the promise and the reality match up.
What's going to be key in distinguishing who wins and loses, given your view of the future?
Education, policy, thoughts about future work, and ensuring the skill sets are there to meet the future needs of the workforce.
Well, thank you.
The other thing is longer-term planning,
Yeah, long-term planning, long-term thinking.
All right, we'll pick up a copy of the book to find out more. We're reading The Rise of Techno-Socialism, How Inequality, AI, and Climate Will Usher in a New World. Thank you so much for joining me, Brett King and Dr. Richard Petty.
Thank you, Michelle.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.